Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs here at Princeton University. And this is my colleague and co-host, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also co-founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So usually when Sam and I are trying to figure out the world of politics, when we're not just talking ourselves, we talk to journalists, we talk to politicos, but both of us agree that culture is another great avenue in which politics can be discussed in really powerful ways and in ways that are often more real to many Americans. Many episodes ago, we had Robert Schenken, who wrote the play and movie All the Way about Lyndon Johnson, and had a great discussion about legislative politics. And music's another important avenue historically for political discussion. There's a long tradition of political music. Bob Dylan and Joan Baez in the 1960s were the anthem for civil rights activists and anti-war activists. Public Enemy and other rap artists have been...
Woody Guthrie
and Public Enemy and other rap artists have been very important to collective action against racial injustice. And today we're fortunate, beyond fortunate, to have with us two amazing artists, Mike Cooley and Patterson Hood, the co-founders and lead singers of the band The Drive-By Truckers. For those of you who don't know them, and all of you should, The Drive-By Truckers are a very special band that has produced some amazing music over the past few decades. They came out in the 1990s, and they've released a series of classic albums, Decoration Day, Southern Rock Opera, English Oceans, The Big To-Do, Alabama Ass-Whoopin', and many more. If you've not seen them in concert, you really need to, because it's as good as it gets. Powerful lyrics, hard-driving sound, and the classic sounds of the South blended with many other genres. They have tackled many important issues in their music: class relations, race, war, region, evangelical preachers, and even several songs will talk about partisan politics. Their music moves and inspires, and their latest album is probably their most political, American Band, which really, even though it comes out before, it captures the tensions, challenges, and anxieties, I think, in the age of Trump over many, many issues that the country faces. Mike and Patterson, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us, yeah.
Let me start. I was reading this article, Patterson, that you wrote in the New York Times a little while back, and in a piece called "The South's Heritage is So Much More Than a Flag." You wrote that your father, David Hood, quote, "his views on the civil rights era were shaped by the time he spent playing with Aretha and the Staple Singers. He looked at George Wallace and Bull Connor with great disdain and was mortified to think that people around the world believed all Southerners were like that." How did your family background and your father influence some of the ways you write about Southern politics and Southern society?
I mean, it absolutely shaped it. And as did the fact that since my dad was a musician, a lot of my childhood was spent with my grandparents, my grandmother and my great uncle. So I was kind of, in some ways, watching the generation gap play out in front of me, you know, in the living room, sort of, because they were Depression era. They were raised during the Depression, and my great uncle was fought in World War II, and of course my dad was on the periphery of the counterculture, and was a musician in the 60s and 70s, still is, and so I kind of grew up watching all of that play out, and they were. The older, my grandparents were shaped very much by Roosevelt and his policies and the New Deal. And, my grandmother, stood in the rain to watch John F. Kennedy come to town and things like that. So all of that kind of shaped, my political bent, I'm sure, is pretty deeply.
Are there myths about the South that still prevail that you hope in your music you can challenge, and you can move people beyond preconceptions they have of the region?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're myths some of the time.
Yep.
that's the problem, because you have to acknowledge what's factual in order to confront it and move past. People outside the South, I think we both try to show a side of it that doesn't get shown in media, movies, and television. For a long time, there were the Southerners in pop culture and entertainment were either lovable dimwits or hateful, angry racists, and almost nothing else. And
both of which exist.
They do exist. They do exist. That's what I'm saying. It's not mythical. But then again, we'd like to get our fellow Southerners to confront some of the myths about themselves that they believe, particularly when it comes to the Civil War history and what they consume and becomes part of them with regard to politics and current events and the world around them.
Well, for you, growing up, I guess, in Muscle Shoals and from really the heart, the deepest heart of the South in Alabama, I'm curious about just what that was like politically. Like, you know, when you, how old were you when you grew up in that area? When we think about, I don't know, people who talked about progressive ideas, did you encounter, you know, what kind of community was that in terms of these old myths?
I'm slightly old. I'm 2 years older than Mike. So I, you know, like one of my earliest memories was one of the George Wallace gubernatorial elections and the election of 1970 that was a really heated, ugly, ugly election. And I was, you know, about to start first grade when that was going on, but I was extremely kind of interested in it. You know, I was wondering what the signs in everybody's yard meant and got, you know, and got really kind of caught up in, you know, who this George Wallace person was that everybody seemed to love so much that my dad so openly despised. And yet I would go to school and say something bad about him because I was just repeating, you know, at that time what I'd heard my dad say. And, you know, the other kids in school had heard their dad say
good things
about him. Yeah. And so there was this, you know, when I started first grade, it was like the second year that my elementary school had been integrated. And, you know, and so I was aware that, you know, the little black kids in my first grade class wouldn't have been allowed to have been there a couple of years earlier. And I became friends with one of them, you know, off the bat. And it was so that was kind of my awakening from a really early age. And I was always really from then on studied and followed politics, probably to a fault.
But let me reach further back in the history of Muscle Shoals. Now, if I think about that region, one of the more famous progressives from that region is Helen Keller.
Absolutely.
Right? She's born in Tuscumbia. She became an icon because of overcoming her blindness and deafness after scarlet fever. But I think people don't really talk about this aspect of her now. She was a famous and committed, I think, socialist, if I remember correctly.
Absolutely.
And so she had a really prominent progressive politics. She was denigrated in some ways by saying, well, you know, she didn't really understand the world because she was blind and deaf. So what could she know about the world? But she was quite outspoken in her socialism. And I want to ask about that. Like, that seems to be an old intellectual tradition. I mean, you look at her. So there's also that. Was that something you were aware of growing up down there?
I wasn't. And my high school's two blocks from her birthplace.
Wow. Awesome.
And I still don't know as much as I should know.
I have to say,
like,
just she was amazing.
Yeah.
And the fact that she rose out of being blinded and deafened and then, as I said, became an icon of socialism. Really interesting. So, you know, your roots also have that.
Yeah, it's a weird place. The Shoals is a weird place because it's, you know, it is, as you said, I mean, it's the buckle of the Bible Belt. You know, when we were growing up, it was still a dry county. And, you know, there were, go to the Tennessee state line to buy beer. You'd have to drive an hour to buy liquor or go to the bootlegger.
When we first put our first band together and started playing live, people were still kind of getting used to the fact that they were there and learning how to enjoy them.
Yeah. And learning how to run them really badly. I mean, it was not a good place to base a rock band at that time. But so there's that, but there's also this kind of this underground that always sort of existed of kind of liberal thought, you know, from people like Helen Keller and Colbert County. There's two counties that make up the Shoals area. The southern one, Colbert County, on the south side of the river, had pretty deep union, you know, a pretty deep union affiliation because it was a very industrial in that time when there was still industry there. There was the Ford plant and Reynolds Metals and TVA And, you know, of course, our river was, you know, the first dam of what became the TVA project was Wilson Dam. And so all of that, you know, gives this kind of, you know, this kind of underground, even though we were coming of age, you know, in the time of Reagan, who was
I'm not positive about this, but I think Colbert County was one of the few counties outside of Jimmy Carter's home county that he won in 1980.
Yeah.
And I think there's still not really the Reagan Democrats the rest of the South became. Not quite as much.
So one last question, and let's get to some songs. When you guys start and you're becoming a band and you're playing music from this tradition and that has these themes, what was the response? I mean, given the varied nature of the South, including the 90s is a very conservative area, how did people respond to you guys?
Well, we were hated at home initially. I mean, the Drive-By Truckers is actually the fourth band we had together. And our first band back in like 85 through 91 was, you know, we were not by any stretch loved in our
hometown.
They
didn't get it. I don't think we got it, but the audience really didn't get it.
Yeah. And so it was, you know, it was pretty, you know, it's come around, you know, now we're treated, you know, really well when we go back home, but it was a long process to get to there.
And then one song we were just talking earlier that I was listening to the other day from English Oceans, which is incredible to hear because that was written, I don't know when the songs were written, several years ago now.
Yeah.
There's a song, The Part of Him, which is about, you know, Tea Party politics.
Right.
Some of the corruption and hypocrisy of
it was written back when we thought things were bad.
When he got out of line, they snatched him up from behind, put him in a box with fancy trim, rolled him out for all to see, his rendezvous with destiny, someone else will play the part of him.
What inspired that? Was that just the general response to what was going on in Washington, or
it's like I had witnessed through the year this part that different people would play, you know, mm-hmm. like a role you'd play in a movie or something, and you know, every so often someone else comes along and plays that part and plays it with a little bit more. You know, they emote it a little bit more dramatically and they say something a little more outlandish. And I was kind of predicting, you know, this was still the era of, you know, I mean, I wrote it during the, you know, Obama was president, but, you know, the Tea Party people who were, you know, trying to stop him at every turn. And I was kind of trying to predict what the next step was. And like I said, I you know, in retrospect, I probably was being optimistic. But.
What worries me a little going forward is, you know, if this is a pattern, and there seems to be a new role now for the next one to play and the next one and the next one, and this won't be the last one.
Well, it's incredible. I mean, one of the things Sam and I often talk about on this show are the roots of some of the Trumpian politics and that it's not all out of nowhere. And that
no,
you could see
he's always slapped his name on things that were already there. And the conditions that made it possible for him to be where he is were there.
That's exactly right. And that song is just great because you capture this. You even have, I'm looking at the lyrics. You have a line about, for anything that lessened his appeal, his integrity was phoning in, totally Nixonian, honing in on the art of making deals, which, you know, is very evocative right now, given what's going on. But you see the roots in the song.
And there's other songs, like for instance, like in your album American Band, there's the song Kinky Hypocrite, which appears to be about people who talk about virtue and talk about, you know, certain kinds of values, but it turns out they have quite a partying lifestyle.
It was mostly inspired by Roy Moore.
From your home state.
Before the sex scandal.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing was, I was writing it based on him acknowledging that, well, there's not a sex scandal on him. But he had one.
Hot-blooded Bible thump, cash on the barrel, honey, private jets and drunk CEO. From the wanting to the heaven, all the
I'm fascinated because there's this, like,
I'm not surprised.
It makes me think about hucksters, you know, like if you look in, what is it, in either Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn, there's the Duke and the Earl, mm-hmm. right? These guys who go on a road show.
Right.
And they talk about being noble, but they actually turn out to be, you know, con artists.
Yeah.
And so Kinky Hypocrite gives me that vibe of
that's what who, it was mostly. Yeah, that's what it ended up being about was, you know, culture warrior profiteers.
Well, I'm curious about this. So now Roy Moore is for you someone.
I didn't know that. That's incredible. That it was about Roy Moore.
Yeah. That is amazing. Yeah. So do you have guns growing up?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so for you, again, you know, I mean, because, you know, like, look, I've always lived in urban and suburban areas, and so guns were not prominent in the places where I lived. And so you have in your new album, each of you, or your most recent album, each of you wrote a song about guns. Mike, you wrote Ramon Cassiano, and Patterson, you wrote a song about what it was, you know, from the point of view of someone being shot at in an Oregon community college. So I want to hear about that a little bit. So how do you, you know, those songs released in October 2016 seem more relevant than ever now. How does that feel?
Terrible.
Yeah, terrible.
I recommend to our listeners to both listen to the songs and also read the lyric sheet. If you go by the drivebytruckers.com website, you can read the lyrics. And, you know, you really get this powerful feeling of a beautiful fall day in Oregon. And
which is, it was that day. And it's strange. You know, my family, we moved cross country that summer, the summer of 2015. And we moved from Athens, Georgia to Portland, Oregon. And we spent 3 weeks driving cross country with, you know, the kids in the minivan. And the last night we spent of the trip, we spent the night in the town where Umpqua Community College is. It's Roseburg, I believe, Oregon. And it's like 3 hours south of, maybe around 3 hours south of Portland. And So I, when I was sitting on my front porch the morning of, it was October 1st, 2015, drinking my coffee, reading the news, you know, checking the news on the internet, and the story broke about the shooting.
At Umpqua Community College.
At Umpqua Community College. And I'm like, oh, that's that place.
You know, I don't even remember that shooting. It was like five shootings ago.
Yeah. It's the biggest shooting in the Northwest, I think.
Now, if there aren't 10 or more victims, it barely makes a blip on the news.
Right. Know? Biggest shooting in the Northwest.
Yeah. I think it's still,
this is getting to be like the biggest awful. Ball of string.
It's horrific that we can talk about it like that. But it was a beautiful day, just like, you know, my memories of 9/11 was, you know, that was a beautiful morning. It was like a, you know, blue skies, not a cloud in the sky kind of idyllic fall day. It was like that in Oregon that day. And I was looking around, you know, and the birds are chirping and everything's really green. And I'm thinking, you know, how do you wake up on a day like this and think I'm going to go do something like that?
Well, 9/11 was a beautiful day too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, and I'd probably attempted to write something about the shooting thing for, you know, years, because there had been so many, but something about that image of that beautiful morning really just stuck to me, you know. And as the story unfolded over the next couple of days, and there was like a guy who was shot who survived, who had come back from the war from the Middle East, and you know, he'd come back and was going to school and then gets shot in a classroom. And you know, so all of that kind of, I think I wrote the song like 3 days later, actually on an airplane flying to Georgia to meet the band to go do a tour.
And the song about the NRA head, Ramon Cassiano, let's hear about that one a little bit.
That wasn't.
Because you weren't there for that.
No, not at all. That wasn't the song I was looking to write either. Initially started looking at all these guys from the kind of right-wing gun culture seem to have this obsession with the Mexican border. And, you know, I'm thinking, I know border security matters. It's not, you know, it's not insignificant, but, you know, these guys are obsessed with it. They seem to think everything that's coming to kill them is going to go around the world just to come through Mexico to do it. And I ended up just finding the story, and apparently nobody knew it. It was Harlan Carter. He kind of became the leader of the NRA's transformation. in the late 1970s. But in 1931, he shot and killed a Mexican kid, Ramon Casiano, in Laredo, Texas. So, you know, that's neither here nor there. Yeah. It's just, wow. So I just decided to write the song telling that story and his journey from that moment to becoming the guy who turned the NRA into a right-wing white nationalist blood cult.
How do you find, like, a story like that? How'd you...
I don't remember how I came across it. I don't know what I was looking for that led me there, but it you know, the song was just there. It's like his father was a Border Patrol agent.
Yeah.
He shot and killed this guy. He was convicted of second-degree murder, I believe, never served any time for whatever reason. Then Harlan becomes a Border Patrol agent in the 1950s, and he headed up what became Operation Wetback. That's what they called it. That was the official name of the Eisenhower days. And at which Trump, during his campaign, referred to as a really great immigration program. But he was using it as a way to enrich himself. That was never proven, but you know he did it. And then he became more active in the NRA in the 1960s and headed up the hardliners that went against the traditional NRA leadership in supporting gun legislation, which they did. Nobody would think that now, but the NRA supported the Firearms Act of 1934, that banned machine guns, and the Gun Control Act in the late 60s. They helped write that. But then in 76, 77, they were trying to pass a ban on the Saturday night special, which is not one particular kind of gun. It was just a catch-all term for cheap handguns that were available on the street. And the NRA leadership supported it. Harlan Carter and the hardliners were going to take a stand against it, and they took over the NRA, basically. And it's been that way ever since.
That sounds like a history project that I have one of my colleagues writing.
Yeah.
And you guys, I've seen you play. I listen to your music. You're a great rock band. How do you take a story that not just serious, that complex, really understanding the history, and you do this in many of your songs, and turn it into a rock and roll song?
It takes a while.
Yeah. That the story doesn't weigh down in some ways the song, but you want the story and everything you just said to be front and center.
Right. I wanted to get at the silliness of the obsession with the Mexican border, but also that current of white supremacy that runs through the NRA's gun culture that they foster, and how they use that to instill fear, to push overall right-wing policy, and fund it with gun sales.
Well, it's like on Woody Guthrie's guitar, right? His guitar said, "This machine kills fascists."
Right.
And so there's this old tradition of people who write songs calling out these historical lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one, so recently it's the 50th anniversary of the Kerner Report, which is the government commission that looked into the riots of 67 and came out with findings in 68 about two societies, separate and unequal, and it talked about institutional racism in the country, including a lot of the report is about policing and criminal justice. And on American Band, you have really a song everyone should hear what it means, which goes through many of the incidents that have happened in the last, since 2015, even earlier, with police shootings. Can you talk about how you write a song like that, and how do you think of tackling a subject that difficult, that entrenched, and that emotionally wrenching in whatever it is, 3 or 4 minutes?
It was, you know, something that, you know, we've been aware of happening a long time, but I think it hasn't been in the popular consciousness that long as far as, there's been these events that keep happening. And there was one that happened when I first moved to Athens, Georgia in 1995. I was the young African-American man who was shot was actually lived across the street from me about a year before he was shot. And so I remembered him. I remembered his mom out working in the yard because he lived with his mother. And when it happened, you know, there was a big hoorah about it initially, and then everybody moves on to other things, except for the people affected.
How did he get shot?
He was like 20 years old, but he was working at about an 8-year-old level, and they were deeply religious, and he believed that he had gotten a message from God to go to cast off all worldly possessions and spread the word of the Lord. And he interpreted that as take off all your clothes and run downtown talking about Jesus. And his mother called 911 because she was worried about him, and he ended up being shot about, I think, five times, and in front of a crowd of kids, no less. And it was horrific. And this is, you know, this is very progressive Athens, Georgia, which is, you know, kind of prides itself on being a liberal, you know, really nice town. I love Athens. And so when, you know, Trayvon Martin and then all of the, you know, it just, you know, all of a sudden now everybody has a phone in their pocket, has a camera in their pocket. And so all of a sudden it's not just being talked about in the black neighborhoods and in the poor part of town. All of a sudden it's on everybody's computer screen and everybody's, you know, phone screen, and more people are talking about it. And I wanted to address it, and I was trying to think, you know, I mean, I thought it needed to be addressed from somebody that talks like me, somebody with a, you know, it's obviously a white Southern guy, you know, a middle-aged white Southern dude talking about this thing that before had been mainly just talked about in rap songs, mm-hmm. you know, in music.
And it is in your lyrics.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, one thing that's interesting there is that police often get training, and, you know, I think that, like, when we think of the police, we think about violent situations, but this is a case where this is a mental health issue, and yeah. somebody obviously mentally ill,
right.
And there's a need there to take care of people who are you know, not right.
Yeah.
And so,
well, this fear of the other was the biggest. That's kind of an underlying theme, I think, throughout that album for both of our songs. There's this fear of this, quote, you know, in quotation marks, the other, you know, these people who are coming across the border to get us, yeah. these people who are coming out of their black neighborhoods to get us, you know, and, you know, the cop that shot that young man in Athens, you know, he probably, you know, for some reason he thought that this man was going to do harm.
Well, it's harder to know the motivations of somebody who's not of your group, because you can't read people who you don't see every day.
It's hard to hide a gun if you're stark naked, too.
That's true. Yes. Yeah. So you talked about being a white Southerner, but I want to bring in, you know, I'm the data guy on this podcast, and I'm just looking at Google Correlate, and I can see state by state which states are doing searches on drive-by truckers. And this may interest you since you tour.
Oh, yeah, I'd love
it does
to.
A lot.
I don't know this.
Yeah,
I should do my own research.
Yeah, so this is interesting because, you know, you talk about the, you know, like what it's like from the point of view of a progressive white Southerner of conscience. But if I look here, I can see Southern states where there's strong web search activity for drive-by truckers. And, of course, you won't be surprised to know that your home state, Alabama, has the very highest. And there's all these Southern states, North Carolina, South Carolina, reaching up into Kentucky. But there's other states where there's a correlation. It makes me think that it's not just a white Southern thing, but there's, you know, this white rural thing where you're thinking about things, wondering about the world. And the states that come up are Montana, mm-hmm. Colorado, Missouri, right, and to a lesser extent, Minnesota. So it makes me think that there is this community of people out there bound not by geography, but by just, you know, looking at the world and thinking about it.
Class and culture.
Yeah, class. Yeah. And, if, you know, we've had on this podcast Sarah Kenzior from St. Louis, Missouri, and she's written about a book of essays called The View from Flyover Country. And what it's just like living in Trump land and what it looks like to her. And so I'm wondering, have you run into good audiences, as I said, Missouri, Colorado, Montana, are those good places for you guys?
They have been.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we do pretty good all over now. And it's funny because initially our band broke the South later. I mean, we were already doing pretty good business and like on the East Coast and in the bigger cities well before we were doing decent business in our home states.
But you've got, I talk about the national reach here, but if I look at the correlations here, you actually do get a lot of search activity in every Southern state, the Carolinas, Georgia, Mississippi, Tennessee, even in Arkansas, not so much in Texas.
That's funny.
Well, that's a big state.
Big state.
We only play a few cities, you know, so.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And a lot of those searches in the South may not be, you know, may not be because they like us.
Yeah.
A lot of that activity.
Right, a search can go both ways.
Yeah, well,
so you have another song that's out now independently, Perilous Night, which was written in response to Charlottesville, which in many ways was a culmination of some of the things you've written about before. And you have a line, you know, dumb, white, and angry with their cup half filled, running over people down in Charlottesville about the protesters there.
Dumb, white, and angry with their cup half filled, running over people down in Charlottesville. White House furious, the killing side he defends. Fin the upender, yes, he played that tune. It ain't the ending, but it's coming soon. We're making love to Sputnik.
For that song, it gets to one of the questions that everyone in American politics is asking. What exactly is the Trump coalition? And what's the Trump base? And how many of the people in that horrible moment in Charlottesville are part of what Trumpian politics is about? And I'm curious for either of you, I mean, what's your view of what's going on, what the support is for President Trump, and why this could happen in 2017 and 18 in a place like Charlottesville?
I don't know. I think his support is kind of multifaceted. That's one element of it, for sure, the white supremacist, the super haters. I don't think they're a majority of it. I think there are a lot of people, I think, look at those people we saw in Charlottesville, the neo-Nazis and the whatnot, and take comfort in knowing that they're not them. And they're not.
Yeah.
But I look at that a little like, it's like looking at Nicolas Cage in the movie Leaving Las Vegas and saying, well, I'm not that bad off, so there's no need to go into a meeting just yet. You know, like, just because you're not the worst example of doesn't mean you don't have a little work to do.
Yeah, but they're all part of one big coalition.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. Right. I mean, you may not be a racist, but you're okay with racists voting for your side.
I think take our country back means different things to different people in their mind, but it may not mean different things in reality. It may come from the same motivation.
Thoughts, Patterson?
I don't even know what to add to that. I mean, you know, I still can't wrap my head around all of that.
Yeah.
And you know, I think writing that song was an attempt to wrap my head around something that I really can't, you know. And same with what it means, for that matter.
And
I
mean, also,
what it means was a question, you know. It's like, what does it mean, you know?
You know, and in Charlottesville, you know, they were there supposedly to protest the removal of this Confederate monument. I think that was an excuse maybe. But anyhow, just a few days later, just down the road in Baltimore, there were Confederate monuments that were scheduled to be removed. Yeah. They had just voted to remove the one in Charlottesville. It hadn't been scheduled to be removed yet. But they didn't seem to want to go to Baltimore. Why do you think that is?
Right.
Cowards.
Get off of this. So I'm going to talk about another song. There's a song I was listening to this morning that you wrote called Filthy and Fried. And it appears to be about a woman doing the walk of shame with the cowgirl boots, right, the morning after. So this seems to be a song about, like, changing manners and how it's okay for women to have the same point of view as men. So does that come from watching people's behavior at concerts?
Usually when I wake up in whatever town we're going to play in that night, seeing that image play out from the night before out the bus window.
And walk of shame.
And the fact that we call it a walk of shame when it's a she, but a hero's welcome when it's not, was kind of there. But I really just wanted to – I started out just painting that image, and that's all I had for about 2.5 years.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know where the song was going to go, and eventually I realized that's what it is. It's about that age-old double standard, and I was able to finish it.
And so the demographic of your audiences, I'm now just curious about something. It just made me think of young voter engagement. You register voters at your shows?
Yeah, we almost every year have, or every election year, try to have like a table set up and stuff.
This is going to be a big year for that.
Yeah.
Right. You watch those Florida teenagers.
They're my heroes.
They're my heroes. Yeah.
A lot of them are heroes.
Yeah. That it's interesting there, right? Their voices and moral clarity. They may, you know, get hot tempered as teenagers do, but when it comes to, you know, what I'd say cold reasoning about what's going on, they saw what happened.
Yeah.
And it made me think that maybe there's a possibility of youth mobilization this year more than other years.
It's going to be a big. It's going to be a big thing.
Yeah, they're saying youth mobilization, the single college-educated women's vote are going to be key factors in the midterm election.
They may actually start, you know, up until now, that younger age group has been about 20% turnout in midterms. And maybe that'll be a trend. Hopefully that won't just be 2018.
So let me just turn. So another theme you guys have written about all of your albums, not all of your albums, but a lot of them, is class in America. And you've written, you know, pretty vivid, powerful accounts of how class works, how it manifests itself. What are your thoughts on how important this is in understanding the country right now?
I mean, it absolutely plays into all of it, for sure. You know, I think I think a lot of people feel left behind from the changes that, you know, culture and the economy have taken in the past few decades. And, you know, and there is no putting the genie back in the bottle, and there is no going back. But it does make it ripe for the pickings for someone like a Trump to come along and say that they're going to, you know, I'm bringing back coal. You know, no, you're not. You know, there's, it's not coming back. But he can say that and, you know, add a few points in certain states. And you know, elections nowadays are close because we're a very polarized society.
And a lot of this division, that's one of the things we were observing and kind of, it was kind of under the surface in writing all these songs and talking about it. It's not left, right, blue, red, southern, not southern. It's rural, urban.
Right.
Right.
You know, that's it's right down that line, you know, in the South and in Oregon.
Yeah.
If you get outside Birmingham or Portland, you would start seeing more Trump signs.
Absolutely.
But I saw almost none within the metro area. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, it's like
I know who they voted for. You know, just because they're not advertising, it doesn't mean I don't know who they voted for. But yeah, it's completely different. So the rural South is where all the Confederate flags are.
And so when you hear about Trump going off about steel and aluminum, where all the egghead Republicans or the moderate free trade types, or not moderate, but the corporatist Republicans who are interested in free trade and industry, to them that sounds alien. But to somebody in, I don't know, southwest Pennsylvania in the 18th district where there's a special election coming up, presumably when they hear about tariffs on steel and aluminum, that seems like that might be music to their ears.
It is. And, you know, when a person wants to hear, is really hungry to hear a message, and someone is just shameless and amoral enough to say it, whether there's a shred of truth to it or not, it's powerful to them. It is music to their ears.
You guys, just like looking at your career, probably, I don't know how much you think about issues like this. You've done incredibly well. You've been a very successful band. And yet, given everything we've just discussed, you deal with very tough topics. You deal with controversial topics. You have songs with a pretty rich history in terms of storytelling. They're not thin stories, and they're actually rooted in things that happened. How have you managed to take all of that and turn it into a really, you know, popular, terrific rock and roll band operation? What do you think?
Wow, that's a question. Like, are you awesome or really awesome?
Well, no. I mean, as a parent, you know, there's often criticism about where pop culture is and what you can or can't do in music or film. And you guys are an example. You can do some pretty serious things, and there's room for it.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you?
There's so many different ways and avenues these days for people to discover music and other forms of pop culture. Comedy is, you know, really. You know, a lot of great comedians have been taken off talking about these same subjects with YouTube channels. You know, they're not having to grunt it out in the comedy clubs until they get to go on the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
So it does create more space for different kinds of things. And I just don't like love songs. I don't think I could write one if somebody put a gun to my head.
But music and comedy, these are domains that, where truth telling is a major part of it.
And
there is a need for truth telling, and and in creating music, you're under more pressure to tell the truth and not say tell both sides. I guess you don't need to worry about being fair and balanced
I think that's a farce. I don't think truth is not fair or balanced. There is no other side. There aren't two sides to everything. Sometimes there's only one. Sometimes there's a dozen. There's almost never two.
Right.
Do you think you'll continue a lot? Maybe I'm wrong, but you've gotten more political in the last couple of albums explicitly.
It's gotten more obvious.
Do you think you're going to continue along those lines, or do you think you might move away from it?
I hope to do a little of both.
Yeah.
Yeah, same here.
I'd like to not lose the ability to write about something that's just simply human.
Well, let me back up a little bit and talk about, like, you know, music and culture and, you know, writing about what moves people and so on. I'm looking through the lyrics of your albums, thinking about your work. You said that there are these places where people fly Confederate flags. So, you know, thinking back over your life, living in communities where there's a lot of that, how presumably you find meaning through the songs that you write, through the audiences that you perform in front of, the work that you generate. These are places where people are losing jobs, where what they have is they've got, you know, the guns, they've got some anger. How does one find meaning living in a place where, you know, jobs are not what they used to be, where the nation's manufacturing has changed, where there used to be a steel mill and there's not now? So do you have any thoughts about how, like, when you've met people in these communities, how do people find meaning there?
I think they have trouble figuring out who to blame for it.
Because it's not their fault.
No.
So it's somebody's fault.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the loss of the manufacturing jobs goes back to the 1980s where we're from. You know, in most of the South, these states became right-to-work states years ago. Those kinds of jobs, we've kind of gotten over the fact that most of those jobs are gone. But in the Midwestern states where Trump won, it's still kind of fresh. Those wounds are still fresh.
Right, Rust Belt states.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time, so I want to thank Mike Cooley and Patterson Hood of the Drive-By Truckers. It's been really an honor to have you on the show and to be able to speak a little politics with both of you again. The album is American Band. Definitely go out, get a copy, download a copy, whatever you do, listen to it, and it will trigger a great conversation about some of the big issues of our day, and Perilous Night, which is now out and available as well. Thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having
us. Thanks
a lot. Very much.
And that's it for Politics and Polls. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify, and we'll be back soon.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.